Trump makes a campaign stop in Kendall, and a crime museum finds a new home in Hollywood. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A recent article in Christianity Today asked for the president's removal. Now, President Trump has launched a coalition of evangelical supporters, and he chose a West Kendall mega church to make the announcement. We'll look back on Friday's event and the counter-protest from that day. Also, Florida's legislative session is set to begin this month. Today, Democrat Chevron Jones talks education, guns, and marijuana. Plus, Florida has had its share of strange and infamous crimes, like the case of the clinking brassieres.
These girls were busy stuffing rolls of quarters into their bras. They would put as many as $150 a day.
We'll take you to the South Florida Crime Museum in Hollywood and learn about some of the state's most fascinating crime stories. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to those returning from the long holiday break. Thousands of Trump supporters gathered in West Kendall last Friday at the King Jesus Ministry, also called El Rey Jesus, for an event with the president. Now, the event was at a megachurch for the launch of the Evangelicals for Trump Coalition. President Donald Trump talked about voting in 2020, abortion, prayer in schools, and on college campuses.
The day I took office, I got sworn in. The federal government's war on religion came to a very abrupt end.
The event came hours after the news of the drone strike launched by the United States that led to the death of the top Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. We recently spoke with WLRN Broward reporter Katie Switalski, who was inside the auditorium covering the event, and Sundial producer Alejandro Martinez, who spoke with protesters outside. We asked Katie why Trump came to South Florida.
He's announcing his strategy to reach evangelical Christian voters during this election year, kind of like you see campaigns for Latinos for Trump, women for Trump. Now there's the same type of strategy for evangelicals for Trump. And it was really his formal statement to the evangelical community, trying to bring them into his campaign and remind them that he wants to be their president again.
And why Kendall? I mean, you think about all the mega churches in the U.S. Why'd he pick this one?
It's a really large mega church. King Jesus Ministry, or El Rey Jesus, it holds about 7,000 people. And it is a large Latino population. So he saw this as kind of a win-win. And the church itself is large enough to almost be like an auditorium setting.
And just as a reminder to people that the president now makes his permanent residence in Mar-a-Lago, so he's not that far away. You had originally reported that there were thousands of people on hand. I mean, as you said, the church can hold up to 7,000, but there were a lot of people who showed up, and they showed up very early.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people told me they got there at 7:30 or 8 a.m. in the morning on Friday for the president's speech didn't start until 5 p.m. So it was very much a community event where people spent the whole day. There was music outside, a lot of Christian rock. There were food trucks. You could get fried Oreos. It was certainly an all-day gathering. Could buy Trump memorabilia, hats, campaign merchandise. And so it was really interesting. A lot of the people that were there, they were not necessarily parishioners of El Rey Jesus.
Yeah, no, I was wondering how many people were there that you met from out of town?
I actually talked to a lot of people who drove down from different parts of Broward County. So I talked to a couple people that came down from Pembroke Pines and Plantation and Fort Lauderdale. And I saw a lot of walking around. I saw a lot of shirts for a different mega church in South Florida, Church by the Glades up in Coral Springs. So people, I think, across the South Florida evangelical Christian faith came down to see the president speak here.
And Alejandra, you were there as well. You were walking around. You met supporters. You met protesters. But what about you? What did you see? What was going on around outside?
Yeah, so out-of-towners I met, most of them were vendors, and one was from North Carolina. And then outside, I talked to a bunch of Latinos. There was There was Mexican, Honduran, Salvadorian, Nicaraguan, and Cuban and Venezuelan. Oh, and I talked to one Colombian woman as well. Most of the people I talked were Latinos. I don't know if it's because there was a bunch of Latinos. I mean, this is a big Hispanic population church. But all of them were just talking to me about, you know, how big of supporters they were and how their faith is so tied to their politics.
Katie, I mean, you know, the speech, part of the speech at least, was televised. And it didn't seem to go that long, but, I mean, compared to some of the speeches he's made, he did talk about the airstrike that killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. But what else did the president say about that airstrike?
He actually opened his speech talking about recent events and the airstrike that killed the military leader. And he started off sort of, I mean, those were his opening lines. And he talked a lot about how the bloody rampage is now over and that this happened at his direction. And he really used it as a selling point. He was very proud. And the audience seemed to react very positively to what had happened and to him bringing it up.
And you talked to a woman who is very supportive of the president and especially about these actions, again, in the strike in Iraq. And her name is Patricia Velez.
We finally have somebody that stands up and does something instead of sitting back and watching them do things to us and getting away with it.
So, Katie, did you hear from any Trump supporters who had concerns about the attack, or maybe they disagreed with it?
I did not. I did not hear that from Trump supporters. And certainly that was not the reaction from the audience of people. And the way the press pool is set up at these rallies is that we are in sort of a fenced off circle in the middle of the crowd. So if the church is sort of like a circle, the press is in the middle and we're surrounded. So I can see all of the seats. And it was really interesting that, you know, I did not see anyone sort of heckle him or disagree with the president inside the church.
Alejandra, yeah, you met with the protesters, and obviously that's a big issue for them. But yeah, I mean, yeah, what did you hear from people about the term impeachment?
Yeah, there was a couple people that I talked to, and they were telling me that this impeachment wasn't a concern for them because in their practices with this church, and this church is highly supportive of the president. You know, the head of the church is a supporter of the president. They follow exactly what their church is saying, and impeachment isn't a concern.
I'm talking with WLRN's Katie Switalski and Alejandra Martinez, producer for Sundial. Both were covering President Donald Trump's Evangelicals for Trump coalition campaign, and that was an event on Friday. It was in West Kendall. It was at the King Jesus Ministry megachurch. Katie, let's go back again. As we had mentioned, this launch of the coalition, the impetus was an article in the magazine Christianity Today, and they had asked for the removal of Trump from office. That, again, the impetus for this launch. But what did the president say, or did he say anything about that article? Did he attack the magazine, or did he criticize any evangelicals that might have challenged him?
Now, I think he knows his evangelical Christian base is very strong. They supported him overwhelmingly in 2016. And he basically used this rally as a way to sort of keep their energy up, remind them, hey, you have one job this year. It is to spread my message and go vote in 2020. And so I think he knew he was speaking to a group of supporters and used that energy to just sort of not – he didn't need to introduce himself to them at all. They feel like they know him well. And so this was his chance to, you know, after that article, spend some real time in front of them and say, here's why you should continue to support me. So while the article, as you were saying, was the impetus for this, it was not really talked about head on like that. It was much more of a, okay, we all know why we're here, but let's use this as an opportunity to really make sure that you not just know you need to vote in 2020, but you go tell all of your friends you need to go vote in 2020.
You know, there was a counter protest, as we mentioned, some folks who were outside, you know, outside of the church. And Alejandra, you were there. You were talking to a lot of them. There were, what, 30? About 30
there was
people?
About 25 to 35. There was like, yeah, there was a lot of people there.
Tell me, like, compared to where the church is and where people were going in, where were these protesters? Were they in any way in contact with the churchgoers as they were passing
yeah,
by?
Yeah, these protesters were right in front of this intersection. It's Southwest 144th Avenue, and they had signs that said, convict and remove, Trump is a hater, love, not hate. And they were chanting, they were getting a lot of, a lot of the cars that were passing by were honking at them. And then there was a point where these counter-protesters and then supporters of Trump were kind of going at each other, kind of, remove Trump, impeach Trump. And then the supporters were basically saying, go to church. I actually talked to Carol Quintero. She is Venezuela, and she was telling me that she does not support the president, that he is being kind of a two-faced when it comes to the Venezuelan community, telling them that he will protect them, but in reality not doing that. Her husband has a deportation order from 2004, and he's currently detained.
You talked to a couple of different people out there. One other person, one of the protesters, was an Anthony Amador. He studies political science at Florida International University. Here's some of his comments.
In recent events, the escalations with tension in Iran, I think the recent attacks were controversial but extremely reckless. On the topic of Iran pulling out of the JCPOA, I believe that's clearly a mistake. Even as flawed as it may or may not be, it is definitely not the direction we want to go towards if we want to bring peace, stability.
Anthony actually lives in Kendall, and he rode his skateboard to the church, to El Rey Jesus, and he said that this is definitely something that he plans on doing for this new year. He wants to be able to voice his opinion.
Katie, again, as we mentioned, the leader of the church is a Trump supporter. Interesting to note, as Alejandra said earlier, I mean, a big part of this congregation is immigrants, undocumented immigrants. There are quite a few. I mean, did the president or the pastor discuss immigration during the speeches?
Immigration itself was not discussed head on Friday night, but the border wall was. And so the crowd who came to the church, now mind you, the audience was not all parishioners of El Rey Jesus. A lot of people came from other parts of South Florida, but the audience that was there overwhelmingly responded with, standing ovations, cheers, applauding when the president talked about continuing to build the border wall and sort of renewing his vow to protect him, if that's a way to put it. He kept reassuring them that he would protect them from different facets of immigration, standing on his immigration platform that he's been standing on. And I think that's what a lot of people came to that rally looking to hear him say, because before I walked into the church, a few people I talked to, I asked, what are you hoping the president says? Anything in particular? Are you looking forward to hearing a particular message? And I had several people tell me, we just want to hear him continue to say what he's already been saying, but we want to see it for ourselves in person. And so I think bringing up the border wall was very much that moment for people.
Something interesting that Alejandra, that you had pointed out is you heard from folks who seem to put their faith before politics, and they believe that their faith, their church, and God is leading them in believing that Trump is the right choice. You heard from a woman, Edmina De Grandes, from Honduras, and she supports Trump because the church does. Let's take a listen.
Bueno, no sé mucho de política. Solamente le digo lo que la Biblia dice, que tenemos que orar por los presidentes, porque Dios es el que pone reyes y quita reyes, y Dios es el que puso en los tiempos antiguos de presidentes y reyes. Eso. Nosotros lo hacemos bíblicamente.
Yeah, Edmina has been going to this church for 15 years. She's really originally from Honduras, and she's saying that although she doesn't know much about politics and she couldn't point out a single issue that the president has talked about, she says that she follows the Bible and she follows the church. She came with her best friend. They've been coming to this church for years, and she will be supporting the president in this upcoming election.
Katie, you've had the chance to cover many Trump events. What was different about this one?
This one was very distinct and different from others that I've covered, in one way, really. It was a strange all-in-one combination of religion mixed with politics. And what I mean by that is, while this was a campaign rally, it was almost like a worship service, in that there was a lot of prayer intermixed into the middle of the rally, a lot of blessings. The audience outstretched their hands and prayed for the president to bless him and prayed for the media. And there's a lot of strange political and prayer in one, I would say. Whereas at a typical event or a rally, you don't have that prayer aspect. You'll have mention of religious issues, but you don't have the music or the guest speakers or the outstretched hands.
That was WLRN's Broward reporter Katie Swatalski and Sundial producer Alejandra Martinez. And you could read the full story about last week's event at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, should students be allowed to opt out of standardized tests? Our conversation with State Representative Chevron Jones. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Florida legislative session begins next week. The session normally meets in the springtime between March and May, but lawmakers voted to move the session up during this election year. Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones, representing southeastern Broward County, is focused on three key points. He wants to see the state move away from its focus on standardized testing and allow parents to have their children opt into the test. He also wants to see changes to the criminal penalties for marijuana possession, and he wants stricter gun control policies throughout the state. We spoke with Representative Jones last month before his trip up to Tallahassee.
Mr. Jones, what do you see as, you know, the greatest challenge for this upcoming session, not just for you, for the party, but also for the entire legislature?
There has been a lot of things that has occurred over the year since we ended session. One conversation that has become very prevalent in the state of Florida and nationally is the conversation on mental health. And I believe the state of Florida understands it. The governor is putting, I believe, somewhere upward to about $100 million towards mental health when it comes to our schools, because I believe we see it as an issue. So I think that is something that will be on the table to deal with this upcoming session.
Let's look at, for you, two or three major priorities for this upcoming session. Gun control, gun violence issues, and speaking specifically to this, you want to create a task force, mm-hmm. basically, looking at the issues of violence within the urban core. There are studies that have been done, you know, nationally on this issue. What would this task force do differently or add to what we already know?
So the good thing is, and I'm happy. I'm happy. I spoke with Republican leadership because he asked that. They asked that same question. If we can put some type of objectives behind what Urban Gun Violence Task Force would do, and so that would be to look to study the economics within the urban communities. Look at it from the perspective of community engagement within the urban community, and see what other best practices are out there of those recommendations that need to come back to those particular communities. Because I think one thing we're clear on there, and you're right, there has been a plethora of research that has been done from Chicago to Oakland, California. But I believe that when we look at Florida, that we are unique in the one way that when we're looking at what needs to happen in our state, that we need to ensure that our communities have the resources, whether in our schools or whether within our communities, to be able to combat the violence that's taking place within the Black community.
It's consistently an issue, by the way. Try to get federal funding mm-hmm. for research on gun violence. Would you be getting money from the state, or would you partner with a research institute or university? I heard you say kind of like an MSD committee. Is that what you want?
That's what we're looking for.
That's what you want.
That's what
okay.
we want. Same thing of the MSD commission, where the governor gets picks two people, the Senate president picks two people, the Speaker of the House picks two, the minority leader of the House picks two people, and the minority leader of the Senate picks two people. It's a balance commission where it's mixed of Democrats and Republicans that come together to have this conversation about urban gun violence task force, urban gun violence.
The other thing that always comes up with this, I mean, after MSD, and this was a question, was, you look, this horrible tragedy happens in a school, predominantly white school.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden we're hearing people in the minority communities, we've been dealing with this for a while, you're ignoring it.
Just right after.
I'm getting that this is part to try to bring attention to this and say it's not just when you have a mass shooting in a school.
Exactly.
This is a regular thing.
It's a regular thing that's happening. Right after MSD happened on February 14th, the next day, seven individuals were shot in Miami-Dade County. And it brought no attention into it. And please understand that this is not an us against them. Again, like I said in the beginning, this conversation should have never happened separately. It should have been a conversation where the urban community should have been at the table on MSD. Because truth be told, when we're looking at like banning assault rifles in the black community, we understand that it needs to be done. But they're not getting guns in that manner. They're stealing the guns. We don't just have a problem with the guns. We have a problem with how these killers who are on the street are being prosecuted. That, you mean, these individuals who we know who they are, the state attorneys, they have to understand that these people are murderers. And we are letting them back on the street and they are killing based off retaliation.
Do you get a sense from conversations you've had there's an appetite for this, especially Republicans would be on board with this?
I would be disappointed if my Republican colleagues do not look at this as being an issue. And I made sure I took a look and I wrote it down when it comes to what research has already shown. And it did say that within urban communities, lower income communities and communities of color, we do not treat social problems as things that needs attention, but rather simply as people think it's just their way of life. And that's not fair if we say that we are representatives of all of the 20 million people within the state of Florida.
One of the other bills, too, by the way, background checks on ammunition. So right now you can go into a store, buy ammunition, just the ammo.
Just ammo.
Nobody's going to check you.
Mm-mm.
What about this bill? How would that work? And again, do you think there's an appetite to even discuss this?
I have not heard Republican leadership speak about it. If I had to bet on it, the answer would probably be no, that they do not have an appetite to deal with it. But I don't know what's going to have to happen that's going to give the Republicans an appetite. And it sounds so silly that we have to say Democrat and Republican on an issue such as the violence and the mass murders and the mass killings that's happening within our communities, because this is not a partisan issue, but we've made it that.
How do we determine who gets to have a gun and not have a gun? How do you do that? How does the state do that?
Well, I think we've done some things that can start having that will put a limit on individuals who have access to a gun, like the age limit. We raised it to the age of 21. I think that's one thing that we've done. But the other step further that we need to go is the background checks. Doing background checks on these individuals, because that is a simple. What I would think that the Republicans can get on board with is doing simple background checks to see whether or not individuals have any past convictions that's dealing with a gun, who should not have access.
I mean, just to say, there are background checks required.
You're listening to a previous conversation we had with Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones. He represents Florida's 101st district in southern Broward County. The Florida legislative session kicks off early this year. It actually starts next week. We spoke with him about his priorities for the upcoming session, including education, gun control, and decriminalizing marijuana.
House Bill 929. This is about standardized tests.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little part of this bill, looking at it, basically stating that a parent of a student attending a public school within the school district must provide written consent for their student to participate in the district's assessment program. Are you basically saying that you got to have a parent's permission for a kid to take a standardized test now? Is that what you want?
What I'm saying is that our children are being overtested. And as a former educator, I test my students, usually test them every Friday. And some of them would do well. These same individuals would take the state test at the end of the school year and not do well, and then fail the class. How fair is that? That we have a standardized test that determines whether or not a child passes or fails for their end of course exam. And and I put it out there to say that my Republicans say that the parents know best. They want to give parents choice. Well, give the parents the choice to whether or not they want their child to take this standardized test. Now, that I don't, what I'm not going to say is that we not test children at all, because there have to be some data point. But this,
well,
because
I was about to ask you, yeah. how does Chevron Jones feel about standardized tests?
So I believe that we should test, but we should not be testing to make children data points, right? We should be testing to whether or not to see whether as far as proficiency. And we need to measure. We have to figure out how is that measured. But it should not be what stops a child from matriculating.
All right, as you said, you're a former educator.
Right.
How do you think we should determine when a kid is ready to move to the next grade? How would you do that?
There has been a study. There was a study out of University of Chicago that looked at standardized tests and compared standardized tests to tests that teachers were given inside the classroom. And of course, kids get test anxiety from standardized tests based on what it says. But they also took a look at what happens when we take what teachers have are testing in the classroom and use that as a tool for proficiency, but given the teachers benchmarks on those tests and how to give children exams. I would agree with something like that, but teachers would need to be trained on how they should grade those benchmarks to make sure that it's being done with fidelity.
A part of how we look at teachers to see how they're performing and how schools are performing are these tests.
Mm-hmm.
So, Chevron Jones, how would you set it up? How do we determine this is a good school, that's not a good school, these are good teachers, these are not good teachers?
The one thing that I'm clear on is that there are countless teachers who are in the classroom who are not doing this for money. There are countless teachers who are in the classroom because they really enjoy doing this. How do we determine whether that we have a good teacher? You can't base it solely off of a test. A teacher having educational freedom in the classroom could give administrators the opportunity to see how well students are learning, not based on whether or not the teacher, he or she, is teaching towards a standard. Because we're not even training the teachers on how to correctly implement these particular standards that, mind you, we are about to change, right? So how do we check and see whether a teacher is good? Give them a framework. Operate within this perimeter. Giving them educational freedom to teach the children based on the circumstance of those individuals in the classroom, because we create this box and level one students and level four students are supposed to operate in the same box. And teachers are supposed to teach these kids the same exact way, where a lot of students do not learn the same.
Before I leave education, I wanted your take on the fact that the governor wants to spend more money on getting teachers more pay.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of his plan?
I'm not a fan of the plan if it does not address us making sure that we take care of our veteran teachers. I'm a fan of the teacher pay raise. I believe that's something that needs to happen. $47,500, I believe it needs to happen. But there are veteran teachers in the classroom who have been teaching 10, 15 years. And now you're saying that an individual who is new to the profession can come in and practically make the same thing. That's a slap in the face. The teachers, we should move back to a STEP program to where teachers who can move up every other year or every 2 years, however we want to do it, we need to move into a STEP program.
You have a bill you're pushing that basically, again, it decriminalizes the small amounts of marijuana. Here's an interesting point. You know this. There have been cities that have been trying to pass their own rules on this, to say to tell their cops, listen, small amount of pot, leave them alone. Because there is an issue with too many people in jail. But you got a smile on your face. What is that? What do you mean? What's going on?
I'm smiling because there are cities that have it currently right now.
Right.
Miami-Dade County,
right.
Broward County. But please know, and I'm sorry to say it, but Miami-Dade County passed an ordinance to pass small amounts of marijuana, to not arrest for small amounts of marijuana and give civil citation. They gave police the opportunity to be able to do that. But it has not been fair. Black and Hispanics have been arrested, while our white counterparts have been given the luxury of having a civil citation. That's where the injustice steps in.
How does your bill then break through the race barrier on this and make it more fair?
I'm going to be honest with you. You can't legislate morale.
It sounds like this is an issue in police.
I can't speak for all police officers, but there are some bad police officers out there who we can pass legislation on body cameras. We can pass legislation on marijuana. It doesn't matter. You will constantly have those bad cops who are out there who just want to do what they want to do.
And again, your bill basically is just saying, look, for a small amount for adults,
mm-hmm.
we don't want to criminalize people for that.
Yeah,
we're talking a small amount.
Small amounts
is what?
20 grams.
Okay.
Yeah.
For juveniles, you really you want to go out of your way here because you don't want to ruin a kid's future.
Nope.
You're trying to help them not have that record.
Yep. And we're trying to help them not have that record. And I personally am a understand the effects of a juvenile being their life being messed up because they made a mistake in my own family, my own nephew. So I get it. And I fight hard for our juveniles to make sure that they are not a part of that that unfortunate event.
What about if you have a person who is driving a car mm-hmm. and they're impaired? Does this tackle that in any way? Even if, again, maybe they get caught,
yeah.
Cop pulls them over. They got a small amount, but we don't know if they were using while they were driving.
Well, I'm not a fan of whether it's drinking or driving or smoking and driving. I'm not a fan of that. But there's no way for a officer to test whether or not an individual is driving with marijuana in their system. But if you're caught with it on your person. Yeah, that's what we're speaking of. The driving aspect of it. If it's, I don't know how a police officer determine whether or not an individual has been smoking, because that can be very subjective, and that's also a very gray area.
You know, two other things I want to ask you.
Please,
about
go.
The issue of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
One, let's just start with this. It's still illegal federally. The federal government can come in and say whatever your rules and laws are.
Mm-hmm.
No,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I've seen this happen in other states where. You know, they had lax rules and all of a sudden businesses started popping up. And under the Obama administration, federal government comes in, shuts it all down. This is, I believe, up in Minnesota. They can come in and say no to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be waiting for the federal government to step up on this?
It probably will never happen. If we wait until the federal government to come in and be our cavalry, I don't think... I don't think it's gonna happen. I think the federal government are very calculated, and I think in Florida, if they see that we have the signatures to legalize it, Florida is a leading state within our country when it comes to politics. So yeah, if I was anywhere near the president, I would be like, yeah, I think we should probably consider becoming the heroes on this idea.
All right. So medical marijuana, legal in Florida. Right now that business is starting to pick up, and there's a lot of talk about the future of hemp. There is a push to get on the ballot either this year or next, or this election or the next, the legalization of marijuana, like Colorado.
Yep.
Do you think it's going to happen in Florida?
I think it will. You can bring me on the day after the vote happens. But I think it will happen. Why not? Legalize it, tax it, and put the money to good use, to education, put it to senior services, but put it to tax it.
Chevron Jones, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
I appreciate
Lewis.
It.
I appreciate you.
That was Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones. On Wednesday, we're going to be speaking with Republican State Senator Manny Diaz Jr. about some of his priorities ahead of this year's session. Well, still to come, did you know that serial killer Ted Bundy was arrested in South Florida? There's a crime museum in Hollywood that tells that story and many more. It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, some of the nation's most infamous criminals lived and committed their crimes right here in South Florida. There were the Dadeland Mall murders. Remember those committed by the Cocaine Cowboys? You probably remember Andrew Cunanan. He murdered designer Gianni Versace. Or the shooting of the iconic mobster Fatty Walsh at the Biltmore Hotel. There's a whole story behind that. Most of these and many other infamous crimes and criminals are highlighted at the Hollywood Crime Tours and Gallery in Broward. It was launched by attorney Chris Mancini. He joins me now in studio. Chris, great to have you.
And thank you for having me.
Also joining us right now is WLRN television producer Mia Lorenzo, who was crucial in putting this museum together, helping Chris. Mia, great to have you.
Thank you.
You know what, Chris, why a crime museum? Why a museum devoted to the most heinous people in society?
Because South Florida is unique in its criminal history. I mean, we have more interesting crime, more funny, weird crime than anywhere else in the country. I challenge you to find anywhere in the history of America that's had a constant series of growth, economic growth spurts, which is all attributable to illegal activity. It's never happened anywhere else.
Be careful. I did live in Las Vegas.
We got it beat.
You're an attorney.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, look, your life has been inundated by crime.
Yeah.
Some of the people might want to have a passion outside of their work. That's outside of their work, but not you. For you, it is work. It's you've been collecting stuff for years.
Yeah, well, those are normal people. Okay. So, you know, we're not talking about me when you talk about normal. But, you know, I go back to the Mariel boat lift. That's how I got hired by the U.S. Attorney's Office to come down here. And when I did, they were mad at me because I was like a half a day late because there's so much going on. You remember the boat lift and the crime wave that followed it. And I went into federal court and started immediately doing bond hearings involving Marielitos that came off. And, you know, there were a lot of great people that came off the Mariel boat lift, but there were also a lot of people that were dumped out of Castro's jails. So they were standing there with tattoos over their bodies all over that tell the story of their real criminal history while they were telling the judge that they were all political prisoners, just like you saw in Scarface. So the minute I saw that, I said, hey, wait a minute, I'm not in Kansas anymore, Toto. This right. is something else.
Why do you think South Florida attracts, why is South Florida so unique, actually, to what you said a second ago when it comes to the types of criminals we have and the types of crimes that are committed here?
Well, it's the last stop on the train, right before you get to Cuba, right before you launch. You get as far away as you can from the traditional power centers in the United States. Where's that? Right here. And we have, since the 1920s, when Al Capone got off the train and was welcomed here with open arms, even though they knew he was a killer, knew he was the biggest rum runner in the world, knew he was going to corrupt the community, they welcomed him with open arms. And ever since then, we've had a deluge of criminals that followed in Capone's wake and laws that have never really kept up with the criminal activity.
It's also a great place to hide.
Sure.
People can come to Florida and hide. Like, yeah. I mean, do you really know your neighbors? Think about that for a minute.
There was a great old Colombian handbook that the cartel put out that told you how to be obscure. So never buy a Toyota, don't wear flashy jewelry. They actually put the handbook out. Now where else would you find that, Luis? Come on, man.
Mia, how did you and Chris come together on this? Why'd you want to get involved in this?
Why wouldn't I? Actually, it was kind of weird. Things just sort of happen. You have to kind of be open to opportunity. And I went out on my porch one day to have a cup of coffee. I looked at the end of my driveway, and I see a newspaper, which I don't normally get. And I grabbed it, opened it up, and I see a whole article about the crime museum from Johnny Diaz when it was over by Lauderdale by the Sea. And then when I called up, I said, this is so perfect for me because I love weird. I embrace weird. This is perfect. And
when
when I called up and the fact that Al Capone was on the other end, you know, the answer, the voicemail, I go, oh, this is perfect. This is great. So I thought this could be the start of a relationship with storytelling about short crime stories in South Florida. After all, on the TV side, we do have a lot of crime dramas that do very well. And why not tell the stories locally to kind of keep that audience engaged?
Why, this is one of those big sweeping questions, why are people fascinated with crime and criminals and stuff like that? Why?
For me, I think it's a form of escapism, and everybody loves a good mystery and try to solve it. So it is, to me, it's escapism. What do you think, Chris?
In this town, you got family members that are getting arrested all the time. Probably your family.
I know nothing. I was not there. I was not at the scene of the crime.
I met your mother. I'm not so sure. But no, it inundates our society. It's integral to our society. Look at what they're doing now with Epstein's suicide. They're trying to turn it into a homicide. I mean, nothing big that happens, and a lot of big crime goes on in South Florida. On a cyclical basis. Right now, the most money that's being made by the cartels in the United States is on blood gold. They're making more money importing blood gold than they are with cocaine.
We go into this museum, and right away at the very entrance, you have this wheel, okay? And on the wheel, it's like one of those, like the Wheel of Fortune. You spin it, and you have all these different criminals on there, some of them very recognizable, some not. You spin it, and then, of course, whatever it lands on, you have a fascinating story. Why do that? What was the idea behind that?
We call it the Wheel of Misfortune, right? And who's up there? Larry King, Giuseppe Zangara. Now, nobody knows Giuseppe Zangara, but he's the guy that attempted to assassinate Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Down here in South Florida.
Yeah. And who's he end up killing? The mayor of Chicago. Shoots him dead right here in Bayfront Park. So we have a who else is on there? Jim Morrison.
Frank Sinatra.
Frank Sinatra.
Adultery.
Yeah. Meyer Lansky.
You know,
I mean, the list goes on and on. All big players in their time when it was ripe at certain periods in South Florida history. And they left their imprint on this place. Like Sinatra was here during the time when the fountain blew and all the hotels on Miami Beach were owned by the mob. Every single one of them was owned by a mob connected family. And that's when Sinatra was down here doing his thing. Getting into fights, getting arrested. The Rat Pack was running around. Dino's was on 79th Street. Remember Dean Martin's place and Jilly's? And we go through these periods,
the Peppermint Lounge.
Where the money's being made and people are attracted to it.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you think about some of the big criminals and you say, yeah, I remember those crimes. Or I didn't realize that, you know, like some of these bigger Al Capone had a link to South Florida. But then you think about like some of the celebrities, because you mentioned Frank Sinatra. Another one was Jim Morrison of the Doors.
Sure.
What was his case here in South Florida?
Jim's known as the Lizard King, and he got that name because supposedly he exposed his lizard in front of thousands of people at the Coconut Grove Convention Center back in the day when he was doing a concert. And
Indecent exposure.
Then he takes off for Paris, where he dies in a bathtub while his case is pending appeal. Now, how do you get a better story than that? Right.
Can I just put a sidebar to that? My father was a piano player down here. Yes, and he worked in some of those clubs we won't mention. But he was playing, and while Jim Morrison had gotten charged, he was out and went to this nightclub my dad was performing at, and he actually got up on stage, and they sang a few songs together, which was kind of cool.
But that wasn't the day he exposed
And I hope your father wasn't involved in
it. No, it was kind of cool, though. I mean, it's just a little sidebar story.
Everybody seems to have a link to some of that past. I'm talking with attorney Chris Mancini and WLRN television producer Mia Lorenzo. Mancini's the founder of the new Hollywood Crime Tours and Gallery. Mia here worked with Mancini on putting this together, this museum, and filmed a number of short documentaries about crime history stories, by the way, as well. So you can see photos and videos of our visit at WLRN.org. Chris, a lot of this stuff, by the way, in the museum is part of your personal collection. You have, you know, like old clippings of newspapers, some fascinating photos, and actual physical replicas of different, devices or pieces of weapons even, you know, used in crimes.
When I was a U.S. attorney, I had a wall of shame that I started in my office. It was a joke, you know, because we were in the trenches every day. In fact, those were the days when you took your life in your hands. When you walked from our office, the old immigration building, down to the federal courthouse, some people got attacked on the way back and forth. There was two state attorneys that were transporting a witness, and the witness got shot to death in the back of their car. So it was a very different place. So we took our humor, black or white or whatever version you could find it, where we found it, and I had a wall of shame that I started putting these odd, weird stories up on the wall, and everybody would stop in the office to have a laugh, you know? And I said, there's gold in them there hills. Something's going on here that's unique to South Florida, and now it's a museum.
You've got stuff that goes back, and it's not just stuff in the last few decades. I mean, you track, you know, centuries of crime in the state of Florida. I want to get to one story specifically, though. This was an incredible story. And by the way, it was in a short documentary, Mia, that was nominated for an Emmy. It was the case of the Clinking Braziers, and it follows the story of women working at a telephone company in South Florida. Okay, the Clinking Braziers, please explain that.
Well, this was a theft ring back in 1950 where the counting room girls, these girls were in charge of getting the money from the payphones, and they would put them in a counting machine. And
they were working for Ma Bell.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. And all of a sudden they thought, well, if we take the money and put it in our bra, you know, roll these quarters up, put them in our bra, how are they going to know how much we took before we put them in the counting machine? So they were squirreling money away before physically putting them in the counting machine. And this was kind of, like you had said, an unmanaged position kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So they had been doing this for quite a while, taking I don't know how much per day, until... You know, one got mad at another one that, oh, she stole my money, the sister-in-law or whatever, and does, of all stupid things, calls the cops and on stolen money. And the cops come and he's like, what are all these quarters? This is ridiculous. And I think it took probably all of 30 seconds. Maybe I'm just saying that for them all to like rat each other out.
Can I add a postscript to that?
Yes.
The lawyer that they hired got paid with quarters. And he sued Ma Bell to get the quarters that they seized from him. And we're talking tens of thousands of dollars here.
What ended up happening to the women?
A couple of them went to trial and got probation.
And that was it?
That was it.
Well, they stole thousands and thousands of dollars back then. That's a lot of money.
They had no system to know what came in, so they couldn't prove how much they had taken. All they knew was they had boxes and trunks and cars full, overflowing.
They
with
tried
quarters.
To do an audit to try to prove the guilt, but Southern Bell was really embarrassed by the whole thing. But the headlines that we found in newspapers across the country, it was known as the case of the Clinking Braziers. Yeah. But the funniest headlines you'll ever find. I mean, how could you not? It was just crazy.
Women stuffing quarters in their bras.
Yes. Yeah.
Another part of this, by the way, is, I mean, because you have, you know, the museum and people can walk around and see a lot of different artifacts and stories, is you have a tour bus and you take people to some of those famous crime scenes. Like where are a couple of the places you go?
Well, we not only do crime scenes, because I don't want people to think that you can divorce crime from history. You can't in South Florida. The two are intricately intertwined. So, for example, we show pictures of what the I-95 interchange looked like before the state of Florida enacted the law that said that there could be no exit or on-ramps into minority-held communities. They did that so that they could bulldoze and reduce the value of all those properties. So, in a way, it's almost a crime in and of itself what happened to Overtown and that whole area. But to answer your question, we go to all kinds of crime places. I mean, the Evergreen Cemetery, the Miami City Cemetery, Palm Island to go see Al Capone's house. One of my favorite things is to go voodoo and Santeria hunting down by the river, because there are actually caves in the river still there, the Miami River, right by Sewell Park, that have been used for years for smuggling. People don't even know there's caves there, but they're a major center for Santeria and Palo Miami rituals. So we go down there, and the tourists love it because it's like a snipe hunt. They go and see if they can find a gourd or a voodoo doll, and we have.
How do you see this evolving? How do you see, you know, you're in that space for a while now,
right,
but how do you see this evolving?
I think the key here is what Mia's done and what I've been working on, which is the future of trying to get a better handle on the part of South Florida, by the people of South Florida, as to what their crime history means today. What's relevant about it today? If we're all, Faulkner said, the past isn't dead, it's not even past. Okay. So if that is still reverberating, if we're still seeing these cycles, what is it from our past that we should be paying attention to now?
Mio, what's your favorite crime story in South Florida? And I have that for you too, Chris.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I don't know. You just caught me off guard.
Okay, mine is Princess Coffee. Here's this woman that gets assassinated in front of 500 people. Who's pushing her up there? The Klan. Who's pushing her up there? Her own people. She, you know, the Me Too movement is going on now. And some women are very courageous in stepping out. But there were a few women in history that sacrificed their lives. At least two of them I can tell you about in South Florida history that tried to make a difference back in the 20s when it was a male-dominated society. The Ku Klux Klan was taking over. There was all kinds of activity going on of illegal nature. And these women put their lives on the line and lost their lives. So I think that's my favorite story.
I do have a story we haven't done, which was about Lena Clark. She was a postmistress in Palm Beach who shot a guy for $30,000. And she went on to go to jail, brought a crystal ball into the courtroom. I don't know if she was just trying to get off on being crazy. She painted her dorm, her jail cell, and she went on to say that she was reincarnated from... Adam and Eve or something. I don't know. She was nuts, but it's a great story, and I've always wanted to do something with Lena Clark.
Yeah, and aspects of the Cruz case, which is going to be going to trial.
Right.
That has South Florida history written all over it. I know we don't have time to talk about it, but it does.
You do have some stuff at the museum about that as well. Again, attorney Chris Mancini, who started this amazing little place. It is the Hollywood Crime Tours and Gallery. And WLRN television producer Mia Lorenzo, who helped out. Guys, so much fun. It really was fun.
Thanks.
Thank you, Lewis.
Appreciate it. It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
And by the way, you can see photos and videos of our visit at WLRN.org. Well, that is Sundial for this Monday, January 6th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to take a look at the sewage problems plaguing the Rio Vista neighborhood in Fort Lauderdale. City leaders are meeting this week to address the infrastructure concerns. Plus, what's being done to address the crisis facing the coral reefs in South Florida? Sarah Fangman is the superintendent of the Florida Keys Marine Life Sanctuary. She'll be at a conference in Washington, D.C. this week discussing the work being done in the Keys right now. And the Jewish Film Festival kicks off in Miami Beach this week. One of the film features a band of Holocaust survivors. They're in their 90s, and they're still playing together. And we're going to speak with the director of the film. Don't forget, by the way, that we do have a book club. Find us on Facebook, the Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. Find out what we're reading for January. You should know by now. Hope you're reading it. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.